Good morning. I'm Mark Reilly here on Air America Radio. It's 6 past the hour, and you're listening to Morning Sedition. Good morning. It's Morning Sedition at 6 minutes past the hour. My name is Mark Reilly. Mark Maron is having a well-deserved vacation. And since he always says good morning to geniuses and philosopher kings and that sort of thing, I'm not going to do that. I am going to say, however, good morning to all cab drivers. Good morning to you bakers who are working overnight. Good morning to those of you who are working two jobs, just opening your eyes, perhaps getting ready to leave one and go to the other. Good morning to all single mothers. Good morning to grandparents taking care of grandkids. Good morning to the entrepreneurs. And a special good morning to all of you who are going to have your bag searched on the New York City subway today. Dan Bashman, how you doing, man?
Good, how are you, Mark?
All right. Chris LaPresto, what's up?
What's up, baby?
All right. Brendan B. Mac McDonald, Rachel Maddow's in the house. Everyone's here this morning. We're all bright-eyed. We're all bushy-tailed. I felt a little out of sorts yesterday, but I'm feeling good today.
Yeah, Mondays are always a little discombobulating.
No, I think, you know what it was? I think I caught a cold from somebody. I don't know which one of you is the guilty party. But later for that, I feel all right today.
All right.
I'm feeling better than Pat Robertson ought to be feeling.
Yeah,
Pat Robertson ought to be. We have a place here in New York. We have a special place for people like Pat Robertson. It is called the Ward's Island Hospital for the Criminally Insane, okay? Because this man has gone over the edge, absolutely over the edge. Now, let's talk, because I have this sheet in front of me that our producers took a lot of time and took a lot of effort to put together. So we're going to start out with some of Pat's past brilliant statements, okay? Last October, during the presidential race, Pat Robertson told CNN that during a meeting with President Bush prior to the invasion of Iraq, the president told him he did not believe there would be casualties. Gee, what color is the sky in his world? In May, during an ABC interview, Robertson ignited a firestorm with his response to a question about whether activist judges were more of a threat to America than terrorists. He said, quoting here, "If they look over the course of 100 years, I think the gradual erosion of the consensus that's held our country together is probably more serious than a few bearded terrorists who fly into buildings." He kind of apologized for that one real, real quick.
Right.
All right. Now, Pat Robertson hit number three in October 2003. He criticized the State Department during an interview on the 700 Club, which is his show. I don't know why they interview him on his show, but they said, and he said, quote, "Maybe we need a very small nuke thrown off on Foggy Bottom to shake things up." Referring, of course, to the nickname for the State Department's headquarters in Washington, D.C.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, who was heading up the State Department at the time? Colin Powell. So Pat Robertson wanted to blow the brother up. In July 2003, Robertson asked his audience to pray for three justices to retire from the Supreme Court so they could be replaced with more conservative jurists. One justice is 83 years old, another has cancer, and another has a heart condition, he said. Some took that statement as Robertson's praying for the justices' demise.
Mm-hmm.
In November 2002, Pat Robertson charged that the Muslim holy book, the Quran, incites followers to kill people of other faiths and disputed President Bush's characterization of Islam as a religion of peace. Now, you might think that this guy with these unchristian statements could not really top himself. But in this instance, he damn sure did.
Mm-hmm.
He got on television last night on the 700 Club and said that America would be well within its rights to assassinate the president of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez, who, by the way, is my main man. I don't know exactly what Robertson's problem is, but he is, of course, the founder of the Christian Coalition of America, advocating a very unchristian response for disagreements between nations, offing the head of the disagreeable nation. Now, Pat Robertson is saying that, actually, we do have a little bit of sound of Pat Robertson. Let us go to that sound right now. It's better that he say it than me say it.
He has destroyed the Venezuelan economy, and he's going to make that a launching pad for communist infiltration and Muslim extremism all over the continent. You know, I don't know about this doctrine of assassination, but if he thinks we're trying to assassinate him, I think we really ought to go ahead and do it. It's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war. And I don't think any oil shipments will stop.
Yeah, and of course, finance and oil are on top of this Christian's perspective, Dan Pashman.
Exactly, Mark. I mean, he said it's a whole lot cheaper than starting a war. That is the Reverend Pat Robertson's reason for wanting to assassinate Hugo Chavez. He said, well, it'll save us some money.
Yeah, save us some money, and we'll still get the oil. So what's the percentage?
Right. So, but you know, morality never entered into any of his statements.
Well, you know what's amazing, too? He goes on to say that Hugo Chavez is a dictator. And the fact is, he's wrong. Hugo Chavez was a democratically elected president of Venezuela. They tried to overthrow him. They had a referendum on the guy. They figured they'd blow him out that way. And it turned out to be exactly the opposite of what America predicted. America predicted that 58% of the Venezuelan people in that referendum would vote Chavez out. In fact, 58% of the people voted for him to stay.
Right, which is a much higher percentage than George Bush got here in the last election.
Yeah, in this or any other election,
right,
for that matter. So I don't know exactly what's on Pat Robertson's mind, such as he has one. My guess is, however, we'll be seeing a 700 Club later, either this evening or tomorrow, where he kind of tries to backtrack or retract or try and make good on what is very obviously a very ugly statement. But see, my main problem is, look, I consider myself to be a Christian, all right? I go to church. I went last Sunday, as a matter of fact.
Right.
I'm not a doctrinaire Christian. I was a lapsed Christian for some time. It bugs me to no end that a man like this can call himself a Christian. It is just absolutely insane to me that a man would say this sort of thing and then call himself a Christian clergyman.
We have the ability to take him out, and I think the time has come that we exercise that ability. We don't need another $200 billion war to get rid of one, you know, strong-armed dictator. It's a whole lot easier to have some of the covert operatives do the job and then get it over with.
Get it over with.
Some Christian, eh, Riley?
Yeah. Well, why doesn't he suit up? You know, if
right.
he thinks he's so
yeah.
big and bad, let him go take Hugo Chavez out.
Yeah.
Now, there's some people who flew into Heathrow Airport the other day that I'm sure Great Britain would rather not have seen show. There are two Brazilian officials who are trying to find out what the hell happened to Brazilian national Jean-Charles de Menezes, who was killed by London police. And now, you see, they get into the very touchy subject. They're getting into the touchy subject of comparative pain over in Britain. Some of the families of the people who were killed on July 7th in that series of suicide bombings are now saying, well, our relatives are being forgotten because everybody's focusing on the Menezes situation. There should be enough compassion in Britain. There should be enough compassion in the world for all of the victims of all of the violence. We see there's always triage when it comes to violent deaths, certainly in the, quote, developed world, whether it be in the United States, Great Britain, or any place else. Some people's deaths make the news. Other people's deaths rate nary a mention. That's the way apparently it is. And there are a lot of factors that this is based on. It's based on race sometimes. It's based on sex sometimes. It's based on a whole bunch of things. But one of the things you cannot do is ignore something because it makes you uncomfortable, because it says that somebody that you like may have messed up. The fact of the matter is, Sir Ian Blair, the head of Metropolitan Police in London, should be looking for another job. It's as simple as that. He should be looking for work, because this kind of an honorable person would have resigned. To be honest with you, to have someone have to admit that people he supervised knew that Jean-Charles de Menezes was not a terrorist but an innocent civilian 24 hours before he said he knew means he's not doing his job. Something's wrong. Sit down. Resign. Get out. But instead, we're now confronted with people saying, oh, you know, we have to compare the pain of his death versus the deaths of 52 Londoners. No, you don't. You
right.
don't have to compare that kind of pain. It is all painful. The people that were involved in those bombings need to be brought to justice, the ones that are still alive. But also to be brought to justice are the cops and the chain of command that ended this young man's life, this innocent young man's life.
You're absolutely right, Mark. And I would just add that, you know, when we talk about Jean-Charles de Menezes and the way that he was killed so wrongly, we aren't doing that to diminish the pain of those 51 people that killed in the bombing. However, that were killed in the terrorist attack. However, when Sir Ian Blair tells us that we should be focusing more on those 51 people, mm-hmm. he is hoping to diminish the discussion and focus on Jean-Charles de Menezes.
Yes, he is. And the reason for that is because someone has to be held accountable. And speaking of accountability, our president is dodging it again out in Idaho.
Yes.
We're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about this charter that may or may not be in Iraq and a whole lot more next. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. It's 16 minutes past the hour.
Hi, this is Mark Maron's mom, and you're listening to my son and his friend Mark Riley. They're very good boys. It's Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. Our guests today include Bob Herbert, New York Times columnist. He'll be joining us by telephone to discuss the president's indifference to the war in Iraq and a recent column he wrote on some really deceptive recruiting practices, which we had talked about some time ago, actually. Karen Meredith, member of Gold Star Families for Peace, whose son Kenneth Ballard was killed in action in Iraq, will be joining us on the phone from Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. And New York Times Sunday Magazine contributor Peter Moss joins us on the phone to discuss his cover article on Saudi oil. And let me tell you, oil is getting to be a four-letter word out here, Dan Pashman, because with the price of gasoline going up the way it is, and we're going to get into that a little later on this morning as well, the price of gasoline is going through the roof, and consumers are starting to change their habits to try and accommodate.
It's true.
You know, it is absolutely scary. Speaking of accommodating, George W. Bush is not doing any of that. He spoke to the National VFW Convention in Salt Lake City, Utah. Do you know, I used to go to the VFW conventions.
Oh, really?
When I was in a drum corps, yeah.
Oh,
because
yes,
they were
porn?
Sponsored by VFW and American Legion Posts, and they would each have championships. So I was actually judged once by then-Colonel Norman Schwarzkopf.
Oh, wow.
At an inspection, yeah.
What did he give you?
Well, it was like a corps-wide thing. They'd inspect and make sure all your stuff was clean and your hair was properly trimmed and the whole nine yards. So I didn't lose anybody any points.
You passed.
I cornrowed my little afro down and put it up under my shake up. But yeah, so Bush, now, when I say, you know, the VFW National Convention, understand that George W. Bush was going to a friendly state to an extremely friendly audience. These are, in the main, war veterans. And what he said, he does this, I guess he thinks it's clever. I don't think it particularly is. But what he does is simultaneously invoke the First and Second World Wars. He simultaneously invokes September 11th. And he talks about the idea that you can't pull back from Iraq because that would somehow dishonor the sacrifice of the troops that that have already lost their lives. None of these, in my judgment, has any resonance, but it did apparently to the 15,000-odd people who were in Salt Lake City. He's now in Idaho, again, speaking to friendly people. Although, you know, the mayor, the Democratic mayor of Salt Lake City, joined about 1,000 protesters in Salt Lake City saying, look, you know, this guy has created havoc in America. And see, this is the thing that I think a lot of people end up missing about George W. Bush's presidency. This man took some of the most positive economic and social indicators that this country has ever had, and he has run them into the ground for political greed, for political power, and for financial gain for his friends. Now, he's obviously not going to tell you that. He's going to tell you that this is all about sacrifice. But the bottom line is, who is doing the sacrificing? Who is it that is, in fact, losing their lives overseas? Nobody that George W. Bush knows. Nobody.
That's for damn
sure.
George
W. Bush knows. And at the same time, of course, the Iraqis had a deadline that came and went. And Dan, I'm not quite sure. You know, this is like turning in a half done homework paper or something. It has that aura to it. I can't figure out exactly what they did here.
Yeah, I think, Mark, they're trying so desperately hard to show some sign of progress. You know, it's like, I can't really tell that this thing is all that farther along than it was last week. You know, but they are so desperate to give the Bush administration and for themselves to have something to hold up to say, look, see, we did it.
Yeah.
That they are throwing out a half completed document.
You know, I keep hearing Ray Charles's "Ain't That Good News" in the background because that seems to be what they're doing. And remember that there was tremendous pressure put on the Iraqi National Assembly by the United States, by the Bush administration, right, by the U.S. ambassador to get something done by midnight last night. So they got something done. They got a draft constitution that the Sunnis still say they are not going to sign off on.
Right.
Now the Sunnis, and we said this yesterday, they're now falling back on position, on plan B, which is to scuttle it during the referendum. If two-thirds of the people in three provinces of 18, Iraq has 18 different provinces.
Right.
If two-thirds of the voters in three of those provinces say no to this constitution, it's done.
Yeah.
Guess how many provinces the Sunnis control?
Three.
Four.
Well, there you go.
So checkmate, right, essentially. But, you know, again, they're doing this. Federalism is still a central issue. The Kurds want some degree of autonomy in the north. The Shia, and this isn't much talked about, the Shia want autonomy in the south. Guess why?
Why?
Because that's where all the oil is.
Oh, okay. They know what's going on.
They want to control the oil in the south of the country. And the Sunnis, who, of course, up until Saddam's fall, were in charge of the country, are saying, wait a minute. No, you don't. You can't do this.
Here's my question, Riley. Why not just break it up into three countries?
Well,
Wouldn't that make things easier?
It would be very interesting to contemplate because remember that Iraq was a British construct in the first place.
Right. It's not supposed to be one country.
No, it's not. But the problem there is, first of all, that the part of Iraq that is most ready to become a country is Kurdistan.
Right.
All right. The Turks aren't having it.
Right.
All right. The Turkish government has already said, you give the Turks, the Kurds rather, too much autonomy, we're going to have to do something about it. They have a long-standing beef. It has nothing to do with the U.S., but remember, too, that the Kurds and the Turks are considered allies of the U.S. The Kurds were not unfriendly to the U.S. invasion.
Right.
Although they had been burned by George Bush's father back in the day when, you know, he told them to, you know, rise up against Saddam, and then Saddam slaughtered a whole bunch of them.
Right.
You know, so anyway, we're getting into a little arcane history here. But it is all history that pertains to how long your kids and your grandkids and your nieces and your nephews are going to be deployed over there. It all plays a role. And right now, George W. Bush is alibying to see to it that they stay there as long as he thinks is appropriate.
Right.
And that is, for me anyway, a very, very serious problem.
Yeah, well, if he's using World War II as a guide, it's going to be a while.
It's going to be a while, right? And he's got a couple of problems at home, too. It looks like another state is suing to stop No Child Left Behind. We'll get to that. We'll get to a whole lot more. Are more blacks joining the Republican Party? Coming up next on Air America Radio. It's 27 past the hour.
Morning Tradition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Minutes past the hour. This is Morning Tradition on Air America Radio. My name is Mark Riley. And another state is suing the federal government over No Child Left Behind. We're going to get to that. We're going to get to the question of whether more young blacks are joining the Republican Party and possibly why. But, you know, Dan Pashman, yesterday we got a really creepy call from that guy that stalks Mark Maron.
Yeah, that was really weird, man.
Yeah, kind of bugged me out a little bit. Let's if we can, Chris, go to yesterday's call from that weirdo. Hello, stalker guy, are you there? I'm not sure.
I only talked to Mark Maron. Sorry, Mark Riley.
Mark's on vacation. He won't be here for the next two whole weeks.
What the? This is just unacceptable. Jeez, I told Mark I needed a schedule.
Yeah, people aren't usually that accommodating with their stalkers. You're just going to have to wait it out.
Tell me where he is, Mark Riley.
I can't do that.
You don't want to get on my bad side, Mark Riley.
Well, no, I really don't, but Mark will be back soon, and you can just stalk him then, okay?
What am I supposed to do until then? Okay, wait a minute. You're making me mad, Mark Riley, and I think I like it.
Uh-oh.
Uh-oh was right, pal. Looks like I'm your worst nightmare now.
Oh, crap.
That's right, Mark Riley. A world of crap. Now I'm just going to need to get your home address, phone number, the route you take to work, family name, stuff like that.
Okay, I'm hanging up about now.
I'll be listening to you, Mark Riley. Okay, talk to you tomorrow. Bye. Yeah, I think this is going to work out, you bastard.
Lord have his mercy. And that, you know, he said, I'll call you tomorrow, which means today, Dan Patrick.
I know, Mark. I'm getting a little worried about you. I mean, he was just focusing on Marin, but now it seems like he's turning his sights to you.
Look, I've been stalked by professionals. Okay? people threatened my life before
this
doing
this.
This
is child's play.
Yeah, it's child's play. Bring the chump on. Speaking of bringing the chump on, the state of Connecticut is challenging No Child Left Behind. And they're challenging on some very interesting grounds having to do with money. What Connecticut is saying essentially is this. No Child Left Behind requires a whole bunch of testing that costs a whole lot of money to do. And the state of Connecticut says, look, we test a whole heck of a lot already, and the government is not giving us any new money to test over and above what we're already doing. Therefore, we don't want to do the testing that No Child Left Behind requires. So now, of course, Margaret Spellings, our education secretary, I didn't think anybody would make me yearn for the days of Rod Paige, but she certainly does. She has repeatedly denied requests from the state of Connecticut for more flexibility. Now, I take this personally because I grew up in the state of Connecticut.
Right.
I know, at least back when I was growing up, eons ago, that you know Connecticut had one of the best education systems in the country. Now, it may not be as good now as it was then. I don't know. I do know that there are several towns and cities in Connecticut that have nationally recognized school systems. So why is No Child Left Behind bothering the state of Connecticut? The government is providing the state $5.8 million this fiscal year to pay for the testing. The Connecticut Education Department says that federal funds are going to fall $41.6 million short. So in other words, they need something on the order of $47.4 million, and they're only getting $5.8 to implement this testing. This is, of course, insane and absurd.
It really is, Mark. I mean, it's just, and what's so ridiculous about it is that we have heard the exact same problem with the No Child Left Behind Act from educators, from teachers, from school districts, from states. Across the country, in red and blue states, we heard a very similar thing come out of Utah, where you have one of the President Bush from a Republican governor in Utah. We have heard this exact same criticism of the No Child Left Behind Act over and over again, going back years since it was enacted in, I believe, 2001.
Yeah.
Okay? It is an unfunded mandate. They passed this law so they could say they passed it, so they could say they reformed education, but they did not put the money in that was required to make this thing work. And that has been true since day one. And they haven't even offered a good explanation as to why they didn't. They've basically just given the finger to people who have suggested that it's an unfunded mandate, even though they have gotten this exact same criticism from every possible corner.
It is called not stepping up to the plate.
Right.
And the federal government ought to be ashamed of themselves that a state like Connecticut has got to sue. You know, we've talked a long time, since this network started, about respecting the service of U.S. troops and how, and within the context of the war in Iraq, the left or Democrats or progressives, however you want to describe us as an amorphous group, were not about to make the same mistakes that we made in Vietnam, which was, to some people, blaming the soldiers for the consequences of the war. And a lot of soldiers that came home from Vietnam were permanently scarred by the fact that there were many people, and they weren't all leftists or progressives, that demonized them, called them child killers and all other kinds of nonsense, when most of them served quite honorably.
Right.
Well, it looks like in this instance, the parsing of the difference between the war and the soldiers is finally starting to pay off, because more and more veterans are seeing the opposition to the war as a protest against policy and not a protest against them. And
right.
That's a good thing.
Absolutely, Mark. I mean, Vietnam was a little bit before my time, but I'm well aware of the angles that were taken by people on the left then, and it is unfortunate that they took the stance they did and blamed many of the troops for what happened in Vietnam when they should have blamed our country's leaders. But I kind of compare it to, you know, you'll often hear Christians say, hate the sin, love the sinner.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
It's the same kind of thing. You know, love the warrior, hate the war.
Yeah.
You know, we support our troops. It's the war that we have a problem with. You know, and I think that it's a good sign that people are starting to make that distinction.
Oh, yeah. And I think that what we're starting to see is these kinds of examinations taking place. And by the way, the entire Bush restatement of, you know, Velcroing Iraq to World War II and to 9/11, of this is taking place in the context of Cindy Sheehan. Mm-hmm. All of this is taking place in the context of one woman who stood up and seemingly created an anti-war movement all by herself.
Yeah.
It's an incredible thing that this woman has done, but it is good to see that the vets are starting to understand that folks who oppose this war are not opposing the service of our military.
Right.
We may not be the ones that decide to go into the military. I don't like guns particularly.
Right.
But I do honor the service because I grew up with a lot of guys who did go to Vietnam. Mm-hmm. I didn't, but I know a lot of guys who did. And when you sit and talk to those guys and they talk about being dumped off a helicopter with a 50-pound pack on their back into a rice paddy, not knowing where they were going or what they were supposed to do, you understand that they sacrificed a lot. And a lot of those people came back scarred in ways that they are still dealing with now, almost 30 years, actually more than 30 years after the fact. So it's good to see that people are not, mingling the idea that the soldiers are somehow responsible for this.
Right.
Dan Pashman, you know, and we're going to talk about this, next hour. The price of gas, man.
Oh, geez,
it's
right.
Starting to scare the bejesus out of me.
I know. I mean, you're one of the only guys here on the show that drives on a regular basis, so it, you know, but that doesn't mean that it affects you really all that much more than it affects everyone.
Oh no, it's affecting everyone. It is affecting areas of our economy that we can only dream about. You know, people, for example, who and this is particularly true in New York, but I know it's true in places like Madison and Memphis and San Diego and other places where you got craters in the middle of your roads and stuff, and you know the cars, the axles are falling all apart because you're driving over. Well, asphalt is a petroleum-based product,
right?
And the cost of asphalt goes up as the price of oil goes up.
That's right.
So it's going to cost more to pave over these roads, just to have the trucks run them into the ground again, by the way, because that's what usually ends up happening. And there's also the cost of airline tickets. There are just all of these ancillary costs that we don't often think about. And the idea that people sometimes back up off, you know, the notion of going out and spending money, not because it's going to cost them so much in gas to get to where they want to go, but if they got to spend $50 to fill their tank, maybe they're not going to go to Target and buy a whole bunch of stuff or Walmart and buy a whole bunch of stuff. And now we're going to start seeing this manifest itself because this is crunch time, Dan Pashman.
Right.
Next week is the week when most parents in America start buying stuff for the beginning of the school year, at least in the Northeast.
Because, mm-hmm.
you know, some places in the South, they've already started school. But this is the time when, you know, people go out and spend a tremendous amount of money on school. School supplies, pencils, pens, the whole nine. And this is a time that, you know, people who follow American consumption look very closely at to see whether or not spending is going to remain at a historically high level or whether people are going to start cutting back because they got to worry about the pump.
Right. You know, you're right. And Mark, I mean, when the price of gas goes up, it affects the price of almost everything that we buy in America and around the world. It affects the price of milk at the grocery store because the milk has to get trucked from somewhere. So now it affects, I mean, Domino's Pizza is charging a $1 fuel surcharge in most major markets for delivery.
What?
Yeah. It affects the price of airline tickets. Like you said, it affects the price of roads. It affects the prices at restaurants and all over the grocery stores for all your groceries. I mean, ballpoint pens and sunglasses involve oil-based products.
What?
Yeah, I know. So this affects everyone and everything. It doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. It obviously affects you more if you're poor because you don't have the same amount of leeway.
Yeah.
But this affects everyone's wallet. It affects the prices that you pay on a daily basis for basic products and things that you encounter on a day-to-day basis. And you wonder why this quote-unquote recovery hasn't been felt by most average Americans.
Mm-hmm.
The price of gas and the price of oil is a big reason why.
Well, I'll tell you what. I don't know what's going to do for Hummer sales and F-150 sales and all these other gas-guzzling. I mean, the Hummer gets, what, a couple of blocks to the gallon
or something? Right, seriously.
I mean, it's costing people stupid amounts of money.
I hear people pay like $60 to fill up their Hummer.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And, I mean, even some of the SUVs that aren't as big as a Hummer, it's still costing $60. Particularly if you live in either coast, New York or California, where they're already paying close to $3 a gallon.
Right. And let me tell you something. If $3 a gallon sounds jaw-dropping, if you get a little sticker shock when you hear that, let me tell you something, friends. You better get used to it. Because if you think that the prices we're seeing right now are some kind of aberration, if you think that 99-cent a gallon gas is coming back, you're crazy.
Not in this lifetime.
Right.
Eric Rudolph won't be coming back to our streets.
Thankfully.
Yes, he has been locked up for life. Are more young black people joining the Republican Party? There are new studies that say yes. We'll get to that next on Morning's Edition. This is Air America Radio. It's 46 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Now, we're not homosexual, but we are willing to learn.
Air America Radio.
I guess you're wondering why we're playing such spacey music at 50 minutes past the hour on a Tuesday morning. We'll tell you momentarily. But first, Kent Jones is here with us in studio.
Good morning.
Hey, Kent.
Everybody, you know, sometimes when you read the headlines, it can be tough to figure out just exactly what the mainstream media is saying. Luckily, we have Mark Maron's iNews 5000 Wi-Fi headline translator right here. Let's crank this thing up and feed it some headlines. From the San Francisco Chronicle, Bush promoting Iraq war policy to veterans. Bush promoting Iraq war policy to veterans. Translation, President continues avoiding veterans' mothers. From the Associated Press, the Rolling Stones kick off concert tour in Boston.
Uh-oh.
Rolling Stones kick off concert tour in Boston. And the translation, Mick Jagger punches out first 9 people who mistake him for Steven Tyler. From the Los Angeles Times, former Goodfellas mobster found guilty of drug charge.
Ooh.
Former Goodfellas mobster found guilty of drug charge. Translation, judge awards Oscar unfairly to Dances with Wolves.
Thank you very much, Ken Jones.
Indeed.
We certainly appreciate it. There he is, ladies and gentlemen.
And applause for Ken.
There we go.
All right.
Now, Eric Rudolph, knock wood, will not see the light of day.
Yes.
He got 4 consecutive life sentences plus 120 years. So unless he's Dracula, he's gone.
Yeah.
He's done. He is, of course, the anti-abortion bomber who bombed the Olympics in Atlanta in 1996, killed an innocent woman, and actually Monday would have been the 18th wedding anniversary for John and Alice Hawthorne. Alice Hawthorne was the woman who was very
right.
tragically killed. Rudolph finally showed some compunction and regret for what he did. I don't know that the families actually care. They did confront him and call him a small man who cowardly fled amid his carnage.
Well, you know, Riley, it was a quasi-apology, but I thought that the apology was pretty offensive, because basically what he said was, I was trying to kill
a government worker.
He was trying to kill a government worker because he doesn't think abortion should be legal. So he says, I can't begin to truly understand the pain I've inflicted on these innocent people, because he basically missed the government worker, who were also innocent people, and he killed a woman who doesn't work for the government. So he says, oh, I'm sorry I killed this innocent person. He didn't say, you know, he basically said, I'm sorry I killed the wrong person. I was aiming for someone else.
Yeah.
That was essentially what he was saying. But, you know, this story really infuriates me, Riley, the whole Eric Rudolph issue. And I'll tell you why. Because by any definition, by any standard definition, Eric Rudolph is a terrorist.
Absolutely.
He is not just a bomber. He's not just an extremist. He is a terrorist by any definition. He is a white American Christian conservative terrorist. He set off a bomb in the Olympics, and if you remember when that bomb first went off, everyone assumed it was a Muslim.
Yep.
All right, everyone assumed it was, but it was a far right wing, anti-abortion, Christian terrorist, American citizen. And the word terrorist never gets tacked on to any article about Eric Rudolph. And furthermore, if this guy's name was Ali Muhammad, all right, you can bet your ass that you'd have Bush right out in front bragging about the fact that they had gotten this guy and the fact that they were putting him away for life and that this was Bush keeping you safer.
Well, not only that, Bush would have spoken out publicly and very negatively about any deal that would have spared this man his life. And they actually did strike a deal with prosecutors. The prosecutors decided they wouldn't seek the death penalty, and Rudolph would tell them where to find more than 250 pounds of stolen dynamite that he had buried somewhere.
Yeah.
So, I mean, on that level, I guess they made that kind of deal. But you're right. If his name was Ali Muhammad, there's no way on God's green earth Bush would not have spoken up had he not been sentenced to the death penalty.
Right. And this guy does deserve to go to jail, but you know, I think that it really is, an institution. Institutionalized and inherent racism and bigotry in this administration's decision not to discuss Eric Rudolph in any significant detail. And it's an institutionalized bigotry in the media to not label him a terrorist like he is.
You're absolutely right. Now, we did play a little weird. Even Chris Lopresto turned around and rolled his eyes a little while ago when we played that piece of music.
What was that? That was
The Planets, Jupiter specifically, by a Japanese musician.
That's what Jupiter sounds like?
Well, if you ever heard Gustav Holst's The Planets, that's what it's based on. But this was done entirely by Moog Synthesizer, by a Japanese guy named Isio Tomita. I've heard the song 30 years ago, but we played it because the inventor of the Moog Synthesizer, whose name, ironically enough, was mispronounced through the entire period of his notoriety, his name was pronounced Moog. Robert Moog is dead at the age of 71. He really did provide a technological wrinkle that revolutionized the music industry. Absolutely.
Right, right. And, you know, we got another clip here just to give people another idea of how instrumental the Moog was. We had that Good Day Sunshine clip, Chris.
No, that's Here Comes the Sun.
Oh, I'm sorry, right. Here Comes the Sun.
That was the Moog in one of its early applications.
Right. A lot of people might not have even known that that was a synthetically created sound.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it was, and that is one of the more important instruments invented this century, in the 20th century, as far as I can tell.
Oh, yeah. And it really all started in 1968 with Wendy Carlos' Switched On Bach, which was, again, you know, classical music played through a synthesizer. There had been people trying to develop this kind of automated way of making music going back to the 1920s. But Robert Moog actually, you know, put it into practice and was actually able to sell it. And certainly his name is, I think, most prominently connected to that kind of... And a lot of people don't like synthetic sound now. We should say, in fairness, a lot of people don't like the sounds that Robert Moog developed. I'm not one of them. I actually think that he really was and created a great leap forward for America.
What's your favorite Moog song?
My favorite Moog song, let me see. Actually, I really like The Planets. I know you don't, Chris, but I enjoy The Planets. There's some other things that he did. Certainly, Songs in the Key of Life by Stevie Wonder, which was heavily influenced by the synthesizer.
Really?
Yeah, absolutely.
Cool.
So that was one of my favorites for sure. Coming up in our next hour, we've got a bunch of them. We're going to talk to you on the phones about those high gas prices. We've got Bob Herbert from the New York Times and much, much more. This is Morning's Edition on Air America Radio. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
Morning's Edition on Air America Radio.
It's 6 minutes past the hour. Good morning.
What?
Good morning.
What?
Good morning. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is out on vacation. We want to say a special good morning to folks from immigrant communities across America. Good morning to bus drivers. Good morning to subway operators. Good morning to members of the armed forces. Good morning to veterans. Good morning to the disabled. Good morning to the homeless. And a special good morning to those of you who are nervously eyeing your fuel gauges on your way to work. Rachel Maddow is here with us. Dan Pashman is here with us. Good morning to both of you.
Good morning, Mr. Riley. Good to be here.
Yeah, thank you very much for being here. You know, I'm starting to get a little nervous. Every 6 months or so, we're starting to see these articles about young black people becoming Republicans.
Yeah.
Now, We should say as a little bit of history, there was a time when most black people were Republicans. From the mid-1860s, when we got the franchise, until the early 1930s, blacks routinely voted Republican. The first black member of Congress, in fact, was a Republican. All that changed during Roosevelt and the New Deal, although some people might argue why, since Roosevelt refused to lift a finger to help the Scottsboro boys down in Alabama in the early 1930s. That's another discussion for another time. What we're seeing now is numbers in terms of voting patterns that say about 91% of black America is still Democratic. But that among the 9% that are left, we're seeing increasing numbers of young African Americans who are deciding to register with the GOP. In many cases, in spite or despite the fact that their parents were part of the civil rights movement. Some people see the civil rights movement, younger people who did not live it, see the civil rights movement through a different pair of eyes. I've always believed that people see things differently if they weren't alive or cognizant of what was going on at the time.
Sure.
I don't really understand what the 1920s were all about because I wasn't here then. I do understand the civil rights movement because I was a kid when that happened. But to somebody born in 1977, the civil rights movement is largely an abstraction. And what they do see are entreaties from the Republican Party. Ken Melman, give him credit for this, if nothing else. The man has started to do that kind of outreach.
Mm-hmm.
And what they've done is they've done a two-pronged approach. On the one hand, they appeal to entrepreneurial instincts in young black people that run far greater than their elders. If you do studies, demographic studies of black America, you find that young black people are far more likely to want to become entrepreneurs than older black people. For older black people, entrepreneurship was not an option in many cases. The other thing that has started to drive a wedge has been the evangelical and clergy push against gay marriage. Because there are some young African Americans who have come up through the church, through various churches, whether the Church of God in Christ or whatever, and they have been told from the time they were kids that homosexuality is evil, that homosexuality is an aberration. And I heard this one preacher, black preacher from North Carolina, say the most incredible thing I've ever heard a black person say in my life. He said, well, if the Klan is against gay marriage, I'll ride with the Klan.
Wow.
Now, he really, like Pat Robertson, needs his head examined, but that's a, that's a whole, it's absolutely ridiculous. But we are starting to see this slow drift toward the Republican Party among younger black people, and it does pose a threat down the road to the Democratic Party's ability to marshal large numbers of black votes in an election, which always turns out to be crucial. Right after last year's election, I got on this air and said that the Democrats need to reengage black people in conversation to create a new post-civil rights paradigm for blacks to become active participants in the Democratic Party. I don't think that's happened yet. And I think that these studies that show a slow drift toward the Republican Party by young black people are indicative of that fact.
Huh. Now, Riley, I'm curious, how much do you think is to be blamed on the Democratic Party's failure to outreach? How much is responsible? How much would you attribute to the Republican Party's increased outreach? Where do you think that line is drawn?
I think the Republicans have stepped into the breach created by the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party thought forever, all right, we can count on the black vote.
Yeah.
We don't need to speak to it at all. In fact, we're going to pretend like we don't have the black vote, and we're just going to kind of nudge, nudge, wink, wink, assume that the black community is going to come along with us. Stop speaking to black interests. Stop promoting black leaders. Stop talking about things in terms of civil rights, in terms of equality, in terms of things that resonate with people who understand the civil rights movement and its legacy. And instead, left a breach there. Where everything that the Democrats are doing is unsaid, so the Republicans get to walk in and say, listen, Democrats aren't talking to you anymore. They're taking you for granted, which was true, for granted. And so by doing very little and not changing any of their policies, just by showing up in black venues and speaking to black audiences, they're able to step into a breach that the Democrats created.
And I think what I find to be most offensive in all this is that at the same time that the Republican Party is reaching out to African Americans, they are at the same time continuing their longstanding policy of giving a quiet but noticeable wink and a nod to outright racists and bigots in various ways. We talked about Eric Rudolph. That's just one small way. Eric Rudolph, the white Christian conservative abortion bomber, who is by any definition a terrorist, who had ties to white supremacist groups, and the Bush administration has not in any real noticeable way celebrated this man's conviction.
Right.
No, and they won't. Don't expect that to take place, by the way.
Well, they also announced the nomination of John Roberts as their Supreme Court nominee, who filed a brief on behalf of Operation Rescue,
Rescue,
the same week that Eric Rudolph got sentenced.
Right.
Like, the fact that they're not making those connections and that they're not being beat politically for the fact that they're not making those connections is a sad commentary.
Yeah, and Operation Rescue, correct me if I'm wrong, Rachel, was founded by was Randall Terry, who got his mail enlist from David Duke at one point.
Yeah.
So it's a short chain of events back to another bigot.
But see, Melman is counting on the fact that most people don't know anything about that.
Yeah.
That's what they count on. And they also count on a crucial, critical error that the Democrats make, and I've seen them make this. When you have white guys who work for various candidates and they come to black people and they utter the fateful words, you're part of the base. Now, that may not seem to be offensive on its face, but to a lot of black people, it's just like saying you're so articulate. It's like you're black, therefore you must be blah, 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 blah. You must be a Democrat. And there are more and more black people that are saying, no, I'm not. Now, let's talk for a moment, because Rachel, you're a two-car family.
That's right.
I'm a two-car family. Cashman is a no-car fan.
You've gone totally urban. No vehicle.
I live in Brooklyn. I have no vehicle.
You have no vehicle. MTA, and I lived that way for a long, long time. And see, the MTA is a great shelter because they don't use gas. Don't use oil-based products. They use electricity. But what we're seeing now is people making hard decisions about what they're going to do, what they're going to pay for to keep their gas in the car. When people, this is especially true in California. In order for people to get back and forth to work and do what they have to do, they have to drive long, long distances.
Yeah.
In the L.A. area, some people's commutes are 2 hours and up.
Mm.
And what's happening now is when you got to pay $60 to fill your tank every week to make that commute, you start having to look at some very serious priorities, even if you make a little bit of money. And if you're poor, forget about it. If you're poor and depend on your car, these are the worst of times. And people are coping in various and sundry ways. And that's what we want to find out from you in our listening audience. How are you coping with the rise in the price of gas? 866-303-AAR0. 866-303-2270 is our telephone number. We want to hear from you. You tell us, you know, because we make a decent living here at America Radio, so I could pretty much, even
present
though
company excluded, but there are people who work here. Yeah.
The check's clear, all right? And I'm able to fill my tank periodically, and I have two cars. So I understand. I purposely do not drive cars that get less than 20 miles per gallon city.
You can't.
That's my, that's a thing I've had for a long, long time, no matter what the price of gas.
Yeah.
Because I just think it's wasteful. To get a car that gets 12 miles to the gallon is absurd.
Well, that's why, I mean, if gas is a quarter a gallon, then you kind of think like, oh, well, maybe I can afford the Viper. You know, maybe I can afford the 11 mile a gallon tank. But it gets to the point where you don't have to be a liberal to want to drive a Prius at this point. You just got to be a middle class person who can't afford to fill up the dumb Hummer at this point.
Yeah, absolutely. And we're seeing more and more technology with these hybrid cars that could eventually really get, I mean, when you start talking about 80 miles to the gallon, then you're talking about some serious, serious savings that would more than offset the increased price of the car itself. Because Priuses aren't cheap. Right. I mean, they're small cars, but they run about $25,000.
Yeah, and you look at the difference between a Prius and the other Toyota, like the Echo, right?
Yeah,
the Toyota
Echo
also gets pretty good gas mileage. It's not a hybrid. There's a huge price difference between them. And so you think, all right, am I going to shell out for the hybrid? Is it worth that much more? Well, when gas is up over $3 a gallon and there's no end in sight and there's nothing this administration is doing to bring gas prices down, that hybrid technology starts to look like a better investment.
Yeah, and as we said earlier, this affects a lot more than just filling up your gas tank. This affects the price of milk at the groceries. It affects the price of your airplane tickets. It affects the cost of Domino's pizza delivery. They added a $1 surcharge for a fuel surcharge. So,
well, I'll be calling Pizza everything. Hut. I don't know. Do they deliver? I don't even eat that stuff.
I think they do. If you can stomach it, they'll deliver it to you.
866-303-2270 is our phone number. Rachel Maddow, thank you. I forgot to thank you yesterday. Twice I forgot to thank you.
You know, but when you made the guy who attacked me for being gay the dog of the week, that was all the thanks I ever needed for the rest of the year. So you're off the hook, Riley.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. But thanks for coming in.
Cheers.
We're going to talk to you on the phones. 866-303-2270. It's Mornings Edition, 16 minutes past the hour.
Join the Morning Sedition. Right now, call 866-303-2270.
What?
That's 866-303-2270.
You don't know until you've tried this.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Damn good.
Blah, blah, blah. 21 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. 866-303-2270 is our number. We're asking you how you are coping with the startling rise in gasoline prices. Coming up shortly, Bob Herbert, New York Times columnist, will be telling us about some devious ways that the U.S. military is trying to recruit soldiers to go over and fight that war in Iraq. Right now, let us go to you on the telephones. And you know what? The check mark is next to someone that doesn't have their name there.
Daniel.
Daniel. Thank you, Chris. Daniel, good morning. How you doing?
Hey, I'm fine.
Good. Turn your radio off for me, will you?
Okay, right.
All right. Well, how are you coping, man?
Well, I deliver newspapers, and I'm considered self-employed, and my route started at 100 miles, and since this has been going on, I take a pay cut, and to compensate what I pay in gas, which has gone up $200 in the past 2 years, I have to deliver more papers, be out here longer hours, and more wear and tear on the car, and just have to work harder to compensate for this, and the Dallas Morning News seems to be really slow in getting anything done. It's just,
what do you mean by the Dallas Morning News is slow to get anything done? You mean you think they ought to editorialize about it or something?
That'll be the day. That would be great. They just seem to, as all big corporations, just to be really slow until we're finally getting a little tired and start to complain to our bosses because every month we get a, well, like every business gets deducted $30 a month in pay, and that's like you go to a food or.
Oh, yeah, know. That's right, because you technically work for the Dallas Morning News.
Right, or independent contractor.
Oh, you're an independent contractor. All right, well, right. Daniel, thank you very much for calling. Wow, so that's somebody's got to drive 100 miles to get their work done
right.
during the day.
And because the Dallas Morning News won't work out a pay raise for him, a pay raise which would essentially keep him at equilibrium, each time gas goes up, it equals a pay cut.
A pay cut for him. Let's go next to Long Island to Debbie, who's listening on WLIB. Debbie, good morning.
Hello there.
How you doing?
Okay, this morning. It's my day off.
Oh, congratulations. You get to sleep in late, eh?
Yeah, but then I get out of the habit of getting up on time.
So how is this gas stuff affecting you at all?
Yeah, well, first of all, I needed to get a four-wheel drive vehicle because I have to be at work before the roads are plowed and before public transportation is operating from where I live.
Oh, okay, you're on the island, yeah, so you would have to take the railroad. And the railroad, off times, it can take
no,
a whole rush
hour. No, I have to be at work at 4:30 in the morning at Kennedy Airport.
Ah, okay, so you
there
do have
no
to get
train
there.
Where I live, there is no bus where I live. And if I don't get to work on time, I'm AWOL.
Oh, wow, so you got one four-wheel, is that it?
I have a Jeep Grand Cherokee with an 8-cylinder engine.
Ah.
It was not my choice to buy a vehicle that big. But when I went to the NYPD auction, that's what they had, and that's what I managed to get at a cheap price.
Now, what is it costing you to fill your tank up these days, Debbie?
About $60 a week.
Oh, my God. $60 a week. Debbie, thanks a lot for the call.
Well,
see, that's, I think, what people are facing. And, you know, in that case, she's got no choice. She's got to have a four-wheel drive vehicle because she has to get to the airport to do her job.
And
I understand.
And, Mark, I mean, just this is off the top of my head, $60 a week. Over the course of a year, you're talking over
$3,000.
$3,000 a year spent on filling your car tank with gas. That doesn't even take into account all of the other prices out in the market that go up because other companies' expenses go up.
Yeah, let's go next to John. He's also on Long Island, but he is streaming on the Internet. John, good morning.
Hey, good morning, Mark.
How you doing?
Great. I listen to you every morning.
Well, thank you for that.
And I really miss Rachel afterwards at 9.
Okay. How do you feel about this gas stuff, man?
It's killing me, man. I'm in the same situation as I was in Daniel. It's like, except I'm self-employed with nobody to complain to because I don't have, I'm not like a contractor for another company or anything.
Oh.
And on top of that, I got two employees.
Two employees? How much is it costing you to fill your tank these days?
I haven't filled my tank in months, man.
Oh, wow.
Our business drives two customers. We are on-site technicians.
Oh.
So we have to drive not just to work, but for work.
So it's really, now do you shop around, you know, they did some surveying a few months ago where they asked people if they shopped around to get the cheapest price, and at that time people were saying generally no. Do you shop around or do you have one place that you get your gas regardless of price?
You know, I shop around, but the pickings are slim. I mean, it's like, you know, 278, you know, near me.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. And that's for regular, you know, I mean, like not super or anything.
Not super, it's, yeah. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Yeah, the other thing is, it's like, I don't know where your last caller was calling from, but we're here, I'm out here in Suffolk County, pretty far east, about 70 miles east of the city. And I got to tell you, man, your thing that comic said about California, not that I'm discounting anything going on in California, but people commute from out here to the city, too, man, and that's like a two-hour commute.
You're right, and that's an hour on the Long Island Expressway by itself, too.
More than an hour,
absolutely. John, thanks a lot for calling. He's right, though. You know, I shouldn't say it's just in California, but see, now he's paying $278. I consider myself getting off easy. I'm paying like $248.
Right.
You know, but
well,
that's because Jersey gas is always cheaper. So those of you in New York, you know, it might be worth actually even paying the toll to come back in if traffic isn't too bad, because gas in Jersey is still, for now, a little bit cheap.
It just goes to prove the old saying, Mark, everything's better in New Jersey.
There you go. Everything's better in New Jersey. We're going to talk to Bob Herbert about the military. Maybe we'll get a little comment from him about Pat Robertson and his insanity as Morning's Edition rolls on. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron's on vacation. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Four minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. And Chris Lopresto, I'm a little nervous, man. We got that call yesterday from Maron's stalker, and I'm wondering if we're going to hear from him again today. He's scaring the bejesus out of me. But at any rate...
I'd watch out if I were you.
I guess. I don't know. But we're going to plow forward. In his column yesterday, our next guest blasted the military for the devious ways in which it seduces unassuming kids to join the military. He's also author of Promises Betrayed, Waking Up from the American Dream, and we're pleased to welcome him back to our show. He is New York Times columnist Bob Herbert. Bob, good morning.
How are you, Mark?
All right. How you doing, man?
Pretty good. How are you?
Good, man. I read the column the other day. And let me start out with maybe talking about a tangential issue that I got from the column.
Sure.
I think, certainly, I'm not old enough to have remembered World War II. But everything, you know, that my parents told me and everybody else told me about living that experience said that Americans willingly decided to sacrifice for the war effort. And I'm wondering, from where you sit, whether or not perhaps Americans are so far removed from the war in Iraq that we don't feel the need to sacrifice.
I'm not sure whether it's a need to sacrifice. I think there's no desire to sacrifice. When this war started, I think most Americans thought it was going to be a replay of the first Gulf War, which they viewed almost like a video game, that the United States would go in there, they'd win the war quickly, bring the troops home, you'd have parades, you could go to the ballpark and chant USA, USA, that sort of thing. And it was almost like a fun thing. You know what it reminded me of? It reminded me of the first days of the, in reading my history, the first days of the Civil War.
Okay.
Where folks went out there south of Washington to watch the hostilities begin, and they took picnic lunches and they had chairs with them, and it was like, again, it was like watching a sporting event or something. And then the horror of the war began to come home to people. So I think that this war was never really taken seriously by the vast majority of the population. They didn't feel they had anything personal at stake. They knew there was no draft, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just an entirely different attitude from the, I think, than what took place during World War II.
Now, it seems, Bob, that certainly military recruiters are taking their jobs very seriously. Your column documented what you felt were some pretty abusive practices. Not abusive of the recruits necessarily, but certainly deceptive practices, probably
deceptive
a better
practice,
word.
Deceptive practice, and I think even, I don't think abusive practices is too strong a term, to tell you the truth. They can't, you know, even in World War II, it wasn't that people were flocking to join up to go fight in the war. People were trying to, if they could find a way to stay out of the military, there were an awful lot of people who were. Of course, there was a draft, and most people who were healthy, most men who were healthy, had to go. In this, historically, and if you recall, going all the way back again, taking a look at history, there were the draft riots during the Civil War.
Yeah, 1863.
Here in New York. So the simple fact of the matter is that people are not anxious to run off and join the military in the middle of a war. And the simple reason is people do not want to get blown up and get killed. And that was the reason why the protests spiraled so much in during the Vietnam era. Those college kids who were being closed in on with the draft did not want to go and fight in Vietnam. It was not necessarily an altruistic thing. People don't want to go to war. So that's what's happening now. When the Army was running those ads before this war saying be all you could be and we can give you some money for college and stuff, and kids were squeezed because it was tough to get a job, then the Army looked pretty good, and people in the Army was meeting its recruitment quotas. Then when the stories started happening, you know, we're at war, and then the stories are out there about people coming home killed and maimed, then suddenly it's not such a good idea. So the Army starts missing its recruitment quotas. And what do? They lean on the, it's kind of unfair to tell you the truth, they lean on the recruiting sergeants and the other recruiting personnel. And they basically tell them, if you don't meet your quotas, we're going to punish you. You won't get your promotions. We'll call you into headquarters and run you through this rigorous physical training drill as punishment and that sort of thing. So these guys are having a heck of a time. I guess it's men and women. They're having a heck of a time. We're hearing stories about marriages falling apart, alcoholism, you know, depression, because these recruiting soldiers, sergeants and others, can't meet their quotas. So what are they doing? They're starting to bend the law. They're starting to violate the law. They're starting
How so?
To sign up people who are not qualified. When people don't have a high school education, for example, they figure out ways to get some kind of a bogus high school diploma for them and get it down. When people have medical issues that they are that would keep them out of the military, the recruiting sergeants are telling them, well, you know, I can't advise you to do something wrong, but if you don't put this down, nobody will be the wiser, you know. So medical conditions don't get put down on the applications. When people have been testing positive for drugs, then they figure out a way to tell them how we can beat the test and that sort of thing. There's all kinds of abuses that are going on.
Wait a minute, you mean that doesn't just happen in sports?
Yeah, check it out. And then on top of that, officially the Army is lowering its standards. I mean, some of the educational standards have been diminished. In some cases, if you've had minor brushes with the law that would have kept you out of the military, you know, previously, they're being overlooked, you know, and they still can't meet the quotas. So
now, Bob,
it's a tough situation.
Yeah, it seems that way. But let me ask you something. I think people would argue that kids would have to be living under a rock not to know that there's a war. Are these recruiters telling kids that there's little chance they'll be sent to Iraq? How are they dealing with the war?
Well, the main thing that happens is they don't bring up the issue of going off to combat and possibly getting killed or hurt in a war. And then in some cases they deceive in some cases, and then in other cases that I've heard about, they flat out lied. I mean, they'll tell kids that you can go to some sweet place. I mean, they've actually told some kids that they could go to Hawaii. In some cases I've heard that recruiters have signed up kids telling them, I can pretty much guarantee you that you will not be going to Iraq, which is false. I mean, that's phony. But to go back to your initial point about, you know, people must be living under a rock if they don't understand that there's a war going on and that people are getting killed. I tell you, you cannot overestimate the extent to which large numbers of Americans, and especially young Americans, are just out of it in terms of contemporary events. They don't know what's going on.
Wow.
You get kids 16 and 17 years old, and these are the ones where the recruiting process begins. They're not reading newspapers. They're playing video games. When they watch television, they're not watching the news on television. Their friends are not being sent off to Iraq. The war is not part of their consciousness. Beyond that, because they're so young, and I mean, I remember when I was in my mid-teens. It was a long time ago, but I remember it. You have this warped view of existence. For one thing, you think you're immortal. You don't think that you can die, that you can be killed.
Yeah, I went through the same thing.
Exactly. So that's what I mean when I say that they're preying on these unsophisticated youngsters. The youngsters don't know much about life and current affairs to start with, and then they're spun this web of deceit where the bottom line is they simply want to sign them up and get them into the military and ship them off like cannon fodder over to Iraq.
Bob Herbert is our guest. He's a columnist with the New York Times. His column in yesterday's Times, Truth in Recruiting. Now, Bob, I heard a very interesting exchange between a woman who lost her son in Iraq, where she said that she really believes that the most fertile ground for recruiting ought to be at colleges that have large numbers of students who actually support the war. How is recruiting going among these people? And in fact, you could argue that big thing that Rumsfeld's doing to commemorate September 11th would be a great place for recruiting.
I mean, that's just a joke. The people who are least likely to sign up are the people people who are hawkish on the war or their children. I mean, how many public officials do you know whose kids are off fighting in Iraq? It's the college campuses and the kids who have a brighter future and the kids who have a plan for their future who are the ones who are least likely to sign up. It was the same in Vietnam. It was the protests against the war were focused on the college campuses because these kids were bright enough to know what was going on, bright enough and aware enough to know what was going on and to know that they didn't want to go. You know, I've been writing these stories. I've been opposed to the war, and I don't like the way the recruitment is going. But, I mentioned in the column the other day, I am not opposed to the military, and I had been in the Army myself for 2 years during in the Vietnam era. I happened to get sent to Korea. Imagine being considered lucky to get
sent to Korea, right?
But I got sent to Korea when most of my buddies in the service were going to Vietnam. So I'm not opposed to the military, and I believe that sometimes you have to fight in defense of the country. When it's necessary to fight in defense of the country, excuse me, I think that that fight should be shared, and I think that the sacrifices should be shared. And so if you're going to have wars, then I think the warriors should be drawn from as large a swath of the population as possible. I don't think privileged kids should be given a pass.
Final quick question. Your column says there's really only two ways to deal with the shortfall in recruiting. Either stop fighting unnecessary wars or reinstate the draft. Which one of those two do you think is more likely to happen?
I think to eventually, well, I don't think we're going to stop fighting unnecessary wars in general, but I think eventually, in large part because of the shortage of necessary troops, we're going to have to end up aborting this mission in Iraq. I don't think there's any political sentiment out there for a draft. My personal opinion is that there should be a draft. I think there should even be a draft in peacetime. Everybody does not have to serve in the military, but I'm in favor of people doing 2 years of national service. So there's all kinds of tasks that you could do. I think that the United States is a great country. I think we could be better, but I think that we all should contribute to the greatness of the country.
Bob Herbert, before we let you go, what you working on for your next column?
Well, you know, it's a toss-up. I'm looking at this constitutional process in Iraq and the way the war is going, but I'm also taking a look at some reports on education because we have a problem with high school dropouts and that sort of thing. So I haven't made up my mind yet. I got about 24 hours left to make up my mind.
I understand. Bob Herbert, as always, great to talk with you, man. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Mark, I really appreciate it. Thank you.
All right, you take care.
Bye.
Bob Herbert, columnist for the New York Times. And coming up next, we're going to talk a little more about that wacko that runs the 700 Club. I believe his name is Pat Robertson, that's his name, who has urged murder on the part of the United States government. Later on, we're going to be talking live from Camp Casey with Karen Meredith, and she is from the Gold Star Mothers for Peace. She lost her son in Iraq. Stay with us. This is Morning Sedition on Air America Radio, 46 minutes past the hour.
Hi, this is Lawton Smalls, Morning Sedition's Planet Bush Bureau Chief. Remember, you can't spell Lawton without W. Deal with it. You're listening to Mark and Mark on Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
CNN's 25th anniversary, Morning Sedition is proud to present Great Moments in Journalism on CNN.
We're going to be talking about Pete here and the incredible things that penguins go through just to basically reproduce.
Yeah. Most people don't really realize what penguins go through. Just being able to raise their eggs and raise their young to adulthood, sometimes it's so difficult. It just, you know.
I got to tell you, we've had a lot of movie stars and things here. No one's been as excited as to see the live penguins. Stay with us. It's going to be hard to top the penguins, but President Bush set to speak from the White House in a few minutes from now with leaders of five African nations.
This has been Great Moments in Journalism on CNN, brought to you by Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Oh, Lord, no love for the Africans, yo.
So funny.
Man, no love for the brothers at all. Penguins get some, you know, penguin mating habits.
Right.
Top of the list. I guess Bush has to meet with some other folks or something.
Right.
Anyway, our next live broadcast will be our biggest ever. We're going to be at the New School here in New York on Friday, September 9th. We'll have former Senator Bob Kerrey and The Daily Show's Stephen Colbert. That's Friday. You like the way I said that, too, Colbert. I didn't say Colbert.
You got it, man.
Friday, September 9th at the New School's Tishman Auditorium on 12th Street between 5th and 6th Avenues in Lower Manhattan from 6 to 9 a.m.
Hey, Riley.
Yo.
Hey, the guy that used to threaten Marin but now threatens you is on line one.
Oh, man. All right. Put him on. Stalker guy, what do you want?
Well, I'm kind of in that honeymoon period where I just started stalking you. I'm getting to know you, finding out things about you, Mark Riley.
Terrific. And what do you think you know?
Well, there really isn't much to know, Mark Riley. It's pretty much drum corps in this job, isn't it? Drum corps season is over. Don't you have other stuff? Do any stand-up, public appearances? I'll just say it. I miss Mark Maron. Where is he, Mark Riley? Tell me now.
Yo, I can't tell you that, man.
I'm calling from Mark Maron's apartment, Mark Riley.
Yeah, well, that's creepy.
I'm kind of feeding his cats. I think we had an understanding. That $20 in change on the coffee table, I'm assuming that's for me. Were his cats feral?
I think they were, actually.
Because they're hiding from me. They don't seem to like toys. By the way, have you seen this place? It's filthy. I'm actually cleaning it right now. I found some dollar bills and something labeled swear at my wife jar. I'm assuming that's for me.
Wait. Hold up. So you're feeding his cats and cleaning his apartment?
And doing a little reorganizing. You wouldn't believe how much wasted space there was in his underwear drawer.
Hold up. You're touching the man's underwear?
I'm wearing the man's underwear. Nah, just kidding. That would be wrong.
Oh, yeah, sure. All right, well, I'm going to let you go back to being Mark Maron's stalker / housekeeper.
Don't get me wrong, Mark Riley. I'm still stalking you. And when I get done cleaning the grout in Mark Maron's bathroom, you're going to wish you were never born.
Does this mean you're going to clean my bathroom?
I just might, you bastard.
Well, I guess I won't be the only one on the All-Star Express to hell.
Riley, I'm a little worried for you, man. I mean, this guy might really seriously break into your house and clean your bathroom.
Well, that's okay. I got three. So
I'd love to have one of those stalkers.
Yeah, I know. This guy's the best stalker ever.
Yeah, really. You know, maybe we could put him on to Pat Robertson. What do you think?
Yeah, right.
Where do they do that? Where do they do the 700 Club? Somewhere in Virginia, someplace. Why don't we send him after Pat? Pat Robertson... Christian conservative.
Yeah.
And I use the term Christian very loosely here. has decided that it is time for the U.S. to step up and assassinate the leader, the democratically elected leader of Venezuela, Hugo Chavez.
Yeah, I mean, this guy is supposedly a Christian and supposedly pro-democracy, yet he wants to murder another human being who is democratically elected the leader of his country.
Yeah, well, you know, he said a whole bunch of ridiculous stuff before. In November of 2002, he charged the Muslim holy book, the Quran, incites followers to kill people of other faiths. In July 2003, he asked his audience to pray for three justices to retire from the Supreme Court so they could be replaced by more conservative jurists. Many took that statement as Robertson's praying for the justices' demise. In October 2003, Robertson, criticizing the State Department, said maybe we need a very small nuke thrown off on Foggy Bottom to shake things up. Foggy right. Bottom, of course, is the headquarters of the State Department.
Right.
So I don't know what's up with this guy. I mean, is he just nuts? Is he senile? Which Christians does he purport to speak for?
I don't really think he purports to speak for conservative Christians, you know, the Jerry Falwell, Bush supporter types, that whole ilk. But I think in reality, if you're a real Christian, then he sure as hell doesn't speak for you.
No, he doesn't speak for me, I'll tell you what. And speaking of speaking for people, the MTA, the New York City's, actually the New York area's Metropolitan Transportation Authority, will be announcing that it will pay up to $200 million to a team led by Lockheed Martin to create a surveillance and security system around major bridges, tunnels, train, and subway stations here in New York. I don't know. That's kind of scary. I mean, you know, they've been hassling about this money for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, look, if it really works and it's really going to keep us safer, then I can. There's part of me that says that it's okay, but that's a hell of a lot of money. We've already pissed away a hell of a lot of money, supposedly for Homeland Security.
Yeah, so Iraq's leadership didn't do all its homework. They have a charter, only a little bit. We're going to talk about Bush's Iraq nonsense and much, much more in our next hour of Morning Sedition. Stay with us. It's 57 minutes past the hour.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.
Good morning. It's 6 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation, as will most of us be next week, except for, of course, Dan Pashman and B-Mac Brendan McDonald. And I believe, I don't know if Chris Lopresto is going to be here next week or not.
You'll be here, right, Kalo?
Yeah, I'll be here.
Yeah, damn. He doesn't sound too happy about it, though. You don't sound happy, man. What's up? Well, he's saving up his vacation, man, because he's traveling the world.
Right. Kayla's a real world traveler.
Yeah, he is. And he's getting ready to make the rounds. So that's cool.
Yeah.
So it's Tuesday morning, and I've been having a good time so far this morning.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I got a list of special good mornings somewhere. You know, I carry a bunch of papers around. I'm shuffling trying to find it because I really did want to say some special good mornings to people that don't always get spoken to on the radio.
I love these so far.
Last
time, I think you said hello to homeless people.
Yeah, I said hello to homeless people.
Homeless people with radios.
You'd be surprised how many homeless got radios, man. They're down in the trains and stuff. I know about these things. You know what I'm studying? Here we go. All right. Let's say good morning to the recently retired, to shop owners, to hospital workers, to school teachers. Enjoying that sabbatical, are you? Garment workers, the few that are left in the United States. Home builders and renovators. Doctors, lawyers, and members of the clergy, but only the sane ones. Okay?
In other words, not Pat Robertson.
Not Pat Robertson or anybody that would believe, follow, listen to, or watch Pat Robertson. Because he's certifiable. As far as I'm concerned, when you come out on a television program in public and call for the assassination of someone who has shown no overt aggression toward the United States. It's not like Venezuelans are, you know, standing at the border of Mexico shooting people or something.
Right.
You know, this is just because he disagrees with Bush's policies. So Pat Robertson says, hey, shoot him, kill him, get rid of him, get a few covert operatives. And this man, A, calls himself a Christian, and B, wanted to be president, for God's sake. The man ran for president in 1988.
Right.
We got George H.W. Bush in his place. I don't know how much better that was. But, my God, how could you? How could someone? Maybe he's senile. You think he's senile?
I wish it were that simple. I think he's more just an evil bastard.
Oh, well, in that case, to hell with him. You know what I'm saying? I was trying to give him a break saying he was senile.
I'm not letting him off that easy, Riley.
Yeah, I know, I know. Well, you know, the Iraqi National Council, I don't know how much, the National Assembly, I should say, I don't know how easy they're getting off. They've come up with a draft constitution, which is essentially like, you know, and I used to have this happen to me when I was a kid all the time because I was not great on homework, you know, and I would do half of it, and my teacher would come up and they say, well, where's the other half?
Right.
Well, and at this point, that's what the Iraqis have done. They've drawn up half a constitution. They've postponed a vote on it for 3 days, like 72 hours is going to make all the difference in the world.
Right.
And they're doing this because of overt pressure from the United States, because the United States apparently thinks that this is going to deliver some more good news to George. Actually, I should say not some more good news, because he hasn't had much lately.
Right.
Some good news to President Bush as he travels during this long vacation of his. And at the same time he's traveling on that vacation of his, of course, there are still people down in Crawford, Texas, who are fighting the good fight, trying to get this war over and done with. Cindy Sheehan, of course, had to go to Los Angeles to be with her ailing mom, but there are still people who are down there. The Gold Star Families for Peace have been doing a lot of the heavy work. The Crawford Peace House in Texas has been doing a lot of the heavy work. And we have got with us this morning, and it is a real pleasure to have her join us. She's a member of the Gold Star Families for Peace. Her son, Kenneth Ballard, was killed in Najaf back in May of 2004. Karen Meredith joins us on the phone this morning from Camp Casey in Crawford, Texas. Good morning, Karen. How are you?
I'm doing okay. How are you?
I'm fine. Thank you very much for being with us. We really appreciate it. Can you describe the scene there at Camp Casey over the last couple of days? We're getting a lot of media reports that are saying counter-protesters are flocking now that Cindy Sheehan has left.
Well, we don't know what they're talking about. Apparently, CNN was saying that there was 150 counter-protesters and there was 12 of us. And that's just not true. When I heard the report, at that moment, there was one person sitting in their little encampment that's located across from Camp Casey 1, and there's no counter-protester area near Camp Casey 2, which is the bigger, more larger area that most people have been gathering.
How are you dealing with the counter-protesters that you do come into contact with, or are you coming into contact with them at all?
I haven't seen any. I got here on Monday or on Sunday, and honestly, I haven't seen anybody. And I would say that because, of course, that would make the better story, but we're just not seeing it. There is a, I don't know if when Cindy was talking to you, there's a souvenir stand or a souvenir store that's located very near to the Peace House, and they have a big Liberty Bell and big flags. Of course, it's their American flag, not ours. There's signs in front of people's homes. This is a very rural area and big ranch homes, and they've got signs, huge signs across their lawn that says, we support the president and we support the troops, and apparently saying that we don't. But there's no people. I saw one man, seriously, just one man just sitting under the tent, you know, and he was doing nothing, just keeping an eye on us.
Wow. Karen Meredith, do you believe that the media is maybe turning on the protesters that are left now that Cindy Sheehan has gone out to L.A.?
I'm sorry, turning on the protesters?
Yeah, in other words, are they now starting to write negative, more negative stuff about you because Cindy's not there?
I'm not sure that that's true. Yesterday, of course, the president was in Salt Lake City, and so the press corps, the White House press corps, went with him. So it was kind of allowed us to take a breath and say, okay, you know, we didn't have as many people following us around, but there was an AP reporter. NBC has hired a freelance to spend the week just kind of hanging around here. So there's definitely coverage, and I don't feel that the coverage is being against us. I mean, because CNN is doesn't mean everybody is.
Okay.
But
Karen, this is Dan Pashman here. I'm curious, putting aside the counter-protesters, anyone who may oppose you, describe for us, if you will, since we have not been there, the scene at Camp Casey. I know you just got there on Sunday, and it sounds like you were really kind of blown away by the emotional impact that the setup down there really had on you. And can you just describe for us a little bit what it looks like down there on our side?
Well, there's three locations. The Crawford Peace House, there's probably about, 10 or 15 tents there. It's not a very large property, so to say that that's that many tents, it is buzzing with activity doesn't really describe it. It is a well-oiled machine, and there are shuttle buses coming and going and dropping people off, and you can't park there or they're just going to move that car because they got to move people. And then you go down to Camp Casey 1, which is the original site. Driving down this long, long rural road are all the white crosses, and it is very much a site. Apparently, just before I had gotten here, somebody donated red roses, and there's a single red rose on each cross, which, of course, has the names on it. And then a lot of them have other flowers that people have left, too. And they were happy yesterday that they had set up the hand washing machine. So these guys are getting good. They're just not camping. It's very effective, and they've got a first aid tent and food and water, and clean. That's the kind of interesting from a first timer. You know, with that many people, but they've got, they gather up the garbage and make sure it's all, it's all very neat and clean. So people are really devoted. And that's where CNN's truck, we think, is located. That's where the one man is sitting across the street from us.
Oh, wow.
The counter protesters, I guess, finally figured out that they needed shade because they have been bringing a tent. And I'm not sure if they leave their thing up all night. And then you go over to Camp Casey, too. And it's one of those huge, huge, like, corporate tents. And I heard last night that this big white tent had been used earlier in the summer for one of Bush's events. So it was kind of karma that we got it. And someone said we were burning sage to get the bad karma.
The bad vibe out, yeah.
We could cleanse it and feel better about having this tent. But we have porta-potties and nice clean ones. And then Cindy, somebody had donated a trailer. An RV, I think, would be better, a smaller one. And there's generators to run the air conditioning there.
So Karen, real quickly before we let you go, how long do you plan on being there?
I'll be here until Thursday, and then I have to go back to California for a weekend event that I'm doing, and then I'll be back on Monday to Wednesday to see this out. We're having three buses leave here from Crawford heading to Washington, D.C. to be there for September 24th. So we'll be maybe coming to a city near you.
Right.
We don't know the schedule yet, but we'll be letting everybody know that.
Great.
Karen Meredith, thank you so much for being with us. We really appreciate your time. Live on the phone from Crawford, Texas.
Thanks, Karen. And Karen is with Gold Star Families for Peace, which was co-founded by Cindy Sheehan. If you want to find out more about that group and donate, help them out in any way possible. These are families who've lost family members in the war in Iraq, or I believe in any war, but the website is gsfp.org. That's Gold Star Families for Peace. They're doing a lot of great work down there.
Absolutely. And, we've got the Slander Minute coming up. And, that's always a favorite segment of mine.
Ted Fields is going to be in here
reporting for us. And then later
some
on.
Scintillating reports.
Scintillating. And then we're going to talk about the high price of gasoline, the high price of oil, and why it won't, as you very correctly pointed out, Dan Pashman, be coming down soon. And that's because we're going to be talking with Peter Maas, New York Times Magazine contributor, about why oil remains so high and what the bleak prospects are for the future. It's 18 minutes past the hour, and this is Air America Radio.
Morning's Edition, Mark Maron and Mark Riley.
Don't just stare at it, eat it.
On Air America Radio.
We'll 22 minutes past the hour. This is Morning Sedition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on a well-deserved vacation. Coming up, New York Times Sunday Magazine contributor Peter Maas to give us more bad news about oil prices. Man, we've had a real rough day as far as that's concerned. And you know one area that we didn't discuss where oil prices are skyrocketing? We'll get into this with Peter. School buses.
Right.
You know, they use diesel fuel, and they're paying a lot more. And that means people may have to dig into their pockets a little more for some property taxes to pay for the increased cost. Mm-hmm. As everybody's heard by now, Ohio's Republican Governor Bob Taft pleaded no contest last week to charges that he failed to report gifts worth over $75 apiece, including golf outings, dinners, and hockey tickets. That made him the first Ohio governor found guilty of a crime. It's a pretty good story, but we thought we'd tweak it a little on this week's Morning Sedition Slander Minute. Now here's your slander correspondent, Ted Fields. Ted, what can you add to this story?
Well, Mark, I have it on deep blue soporific background. When Bob Taft listed his dependents on his tax returns, he left off one of his kids and included one of his cousin Dave's kids, while his cousin Dave left off one of his own kids and included one of Bob Taft's kids. So they both listed the correct number of dependents, but with the wrong kids.
Why?
I don't know, for a goof.
Well, that doesn't sound like anything. I mean, I can barely even follow it. You got anything else?
Well, I have it on ultra-confident parboiled frit-mott
lady
background that Governor Robert Taft is the great-grandson of President William Howard Taft.
Ted, actually, that's not slander. That's true.
Really? That guy?
Yeah, everybody knows about that.
I thought I made that up.
No, man, no. It's right here in the news story you gave me, see?
Well, let me have a look at it. So, this, who is the great-grandson of William Howard? Oh, God, it's like in the second paragraph.
Ted, what else you got?
Jesus, how did I miss that?
Ted, focus. Do you have anything else for this story?
I heard it somewhere that Bob Tapp killed a guy. With a hoe.
Thanks, Ted. This has been the Slander Minute.
I want to be important.
Okay, Ted.
I want to have some slander. And now I'm always in the background. I never get anywhere.
This has been the Slander Minute with our slander correspondent, Ted Fields.
Girls don't like me.
Maybe it's your breath. Thank you, Ted. Have a nice trip. Ready to get work. Yeah, man. I mean, it's really... Wow. Lock the door, will you?
I've never actually heard anyone effectively slam that door.
Yeah, I know.
It barely even closes.
Lock it, will you? Let it back in. No, you know, it's an interesting... the idea, because remember that in some parts of America, including parts that actually we get, that we have affiliates in, school has already started. And, you know, although school buses, most of them use diesel fuel has skyrocketed right along with gasoline prices.
Right.
And what a lot of school districts are now ending up having to do is cut other programs. They can't raise property taxes right on the spot when this kind of thing happens. But soaring fuel costs are causing people to deal with, trimming bus routes, cutting field trips, and raiding cash reserves, and stripping money from classroom instruction.
Yeah.
These are all the negative byproducts of this rise, this rapid rise in oil prices. And it seems to be something that the Bush administration is absolutely powerless to change.
Well, I would go a step further. I don't think it's that they're powerless to change. I think that deep down, in spite of their lip service, they don't want to change it. I mean, the CEO of Exxon got a 30-something million dollar bonus at the end of 2004 because Exxon had their best year ever.
Yeah.
And we all know how close Bush and his friends are to the oil industry. They're having a banner year. So I don't think they want to change it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Right now, the biggest consumers of oil-based products on planet Earth are the United States. And guess who? China.
Right.
China was trying to buy Unocal, an American oil company. And a lot of politicians were raising hell. They lost that bid. So you know what they've gone and done?
What?
They bought a Canadian company that trades on the New York Stock Exchange and has a huge oil reserve. And guess where? Kazakhstan.
Huh.
Out there in Central. Remember, we've talked about all of that oil that's floating out there
right.
In Central Eastern Europe and Central Asia?
Mm-hmm.
Well, the Chinese are staking their claim. We're going to talk about that and a whole lot more with our upcoming guest, Peter Maas. He is a New York Times Sunday Magazine contributor. He's going to talk about Saudi oil. because that's where we get most of ours from, and that's where Prince Bandar, George Bush's buddy, is from.
Right.
So we're going to find out exactly what's in store for American consumers as Morning's Edition rolls on. This is Air America Radio. It's 27 minutes past the hour.
Morning's Edition with Mark Maron and Mark Riley on Air America Radio.
Yeah, boy! 34 minutes past the hour. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. Mark Maron is on vacation. And right now, you know, we've been talking all morning about the fact that gasoline prices are soaring, and it's affecting every corner of the U.S. economy. And the truth is, the whole world's economy could be brought to its knees if Saudi Arabia, the world's largest supplier of oil, fails to keep up with demand. Our next guest poses these questions and many, many more in his cover story in the New York Times Sunday Magazine entitled The Breaking Point. New York Times contributing writer Peter Moss joins us on the phone. Good morning, Peter.
Good morning.
Thank you very much for being with us. We appreciate it.
Roger.
Now, you know, we've seen gas. I'm old enough to have seen gas prices go up, certainly not as high as they are now, but proportionally back during the oil embargo. And we saw gas prices eventually begin to fall back. Certainly by the end of the last century, gas prices were pretty manageable for most people. Will gas prices ever come down from today's historic highs? And if not, why not?
Well, that seems unlikely. Nobody can say anything with, you know, absolute certainty. But there's a big difference between the reason for gas prices going up as much as they have now and what happened in 1973. Back then, what happened is that supply was artificially removed from the market in the sense of there was a boycott by the Arab members of OPEC. They had the capacity to produce as much oil and much more than the United States needed, but they decided for political reasons to take that oil off the market. That's why the price went up so much. This time around, it's a different situation. There's nobody taking any oil off of the market. What's going on is that basically the demand for oil has now reached the limits of capacity of all the oil producers. They can't pump any more oil out of the ground at the moment than they already are. And that's new, and that hasn't happened before. All of the previous crises have been due to war, to revolutions, or to boycotts, not to demand reaching supply.
Peter, Saudi Arabia is the world's largest oil supplier. How secure is that pipeline, particularly for America?
Well, it's secure and it isn't secure. I visited Ras Tanura, which is the main export terminal through which about 5 or 6 million barrels of oil go every day. And the terminal itself, it's a huge, sprawling port. It's pretty secure. I mean, it's kind of like entering a fortress there. You have to go through several different checkpoints. They have anti-truck bomb barriers, and there are two sets of security forces on the premises. The thing is, though, that there are pipelines all over that country. When you drive from the airport that serves Dahran to Dahran, which is kind of the Dallas of Saudi Arabia, you drive over these pipes that through which flow about 7 million barrels of oil a day. And there's no security guarding those pipes that lead to Ras Tanura. So, you know, you could make some kind of hit against the facilities there. So far, that hasn't happened, but actually there have been oil workers, foreign expatriate oil workers, who have been killed, however.
Peter, do you believe that the U.S. government, and specifically this administration, has properly balanced its need for Saudi oil with its problems with Saudi human rights abuses and that sort of thing?
Well, when I was in Saudi Arabia, which was just about a month ago, Secretary of State Rice was there, and for the first time, actually, she did criticize very slightly the Saudis and human rights issues. At the time she was there, there were several democratic reformers who were in jail. But, you know, overall, and even American officials, not publicly, but certainly on background, will admit this to you, all sorts of criticism that the United States government would normally kind of direct at a government like Saudi Arabia, where there is no voting that counts, women can't drive, they have no rights that women have in other Islamic countries. The kinds of criticism that the U.S. would level at Saudi Arabia have not been leveled, and that's simply because, in fact, of oil. We need their oil. We don't want to do anything that would lead to another boycott, and we also don't necessarily want to see the royal family overturned in any kind of political turmoil, because, you know, they're a sure thing, at least. What comes next, one doesn't know.
You know, it's interesting. Was that criticism of Saudi abuses ramped up at all because of September 11th and the fact that 15 of the 19 bombers were in fact Saudi?
Well, absolutely. You know, that was a kind of a key jolt to the relationship, which the Saudis kind of reacted to pretty well, in fact. I mean, they went on a PR campaign, and it's become easier, in fact, for journalists to visit Saudi Arabia as a result of 9/11. So they have, you know, taken that jolt and worked on it, in a sense. They've also, and this is somewhat of a key thing, Al-Qaeda has begun staging attacks in Saudi Arabia itself, and that began about, you know, 2 years ago or so. Up until that point, you know, the Saudis really didn't think it was that big of a deal. They thought that, you know, there were other things that America should be doing to fight Al-Qaeda. But once the attacks started happening in Saudi Arabia itself, they became a bit more serious about cracking down on it.
Can any interruption, and not just in Saudi oil, but, I mean, can an interruption in America's oil supply, whether it's from Saudi Arabia, Nigeria, Venezuela, or whatever, what kind of effect would it have on the U.S. economy? We know what high prices are having, you know, the effect high prices are having now, but what would an interruption in our normal oil supply mean?
Well, the first thing it would mean would be a vast increase in the price of oil. You know, $3 a barrel is just a starting point in terms of what would happen to the price of oil if there were an interruption in supplies from any of our suppliers. And even if there were an interruption in supplies from any oil-producing country in terms of sending its supplies to other countries, the market's that tight that any little thing, I mean, even an oil platform in the Gulf of Texas that was not even producing oil but was scheduled to start producing oil, when it was damaged by a hurricane just about a month ago, that caused oil prices to rise just slightly. So any little problem would send oil prices, gas prices, way up. And the kind of consequent effect of that, this has been proven in 1973, 1979, is inflation and recession.
Peter, there's always been resistance, going back in my memory, certainly to some of the efforts on Jimmy Carter's part when he was president, to rein in America's oil consumption through whether it's carpooling or more fuel-efficient vehicles, whatever it is, it seems like any time there's been a relaxation in the price of oil, the price of gas, Americans tend to forget that maybe we need to start conserving a little bit. In your judgment, what would the changes that would have to be made, would they have to be dramatic, draconian changes?
You know, I don't think they'd have to be draconian if they start right now. They would be draconian if no changes are made and then all of a sudden, whether it's a year or two or ten from now, we're facing a situation where the demand has just gone way past supply and so prices of gas go straight up. And draconian measures would then have to be taken, truly draconian ones. If you start before that moment is reached, then you have time to develop alternative fuels. Now, there are different kinds of alternative fuels that are available. Whether or not they can kind of step in and take all of the or shoulder all of the burden that would be needed, that's not clear yet. But you need to start working on it and deciding which alternative fuels that you want to kind of focus on. Do you want to focus on bioethanol? Do you want to focus on solar? Do you want to focus on nuclear energy? Whatever it is, you've got to start that, and you've got to start conservation measures as well. If you start that now, you're going to avoid a lot of pain in the future. But, you know, as of now, at least, it hasn't started.
You know, it's interesting. There has been some talk here in New York, and actually it came up in the last mayoral debate in New York City, about the idea of congestion pricing, something that's worked in London at least to ease traffic congestion. Would that sort of thing ease America's or certainly New York City's oil or gas consumption, in your judgment?
I suppose so, but if it's done as a measure to reduce congestion rather than as a conservation measure, then it's only going to be done in the cities where traffic is highly problematic. And, of course, you know, that still is a large number of cities and would save some gasoline. And it would help. You know, it would be one measure. But I think the key thing is that, you know, there's no one answer. There's no one thing that we're going to have to do. There's going to be a whole range of things if we want to kind of avoid this abrupt and incredibly painful moment of a true shortage. It's going to have to be conservation and conservation in many ways, and, you know, traffic mitigation is certainly one of them. It's going to have to be the development of alternative fuels, different kinds of alternative fuels. using different kinds of cars. It's so much that that's the reason it's important to start now, because you can't just all of a sudden do it overnight.
Mm-hmm. Final quick question. I don't know if you've heard that Pat Robertson has called for the assassination of Venezuela's President Hugo Chavez. Venezuela supplies a good chunk of American oil. Robertson seems to think that that oil pipeline would not be broken if Hugo Chavez were no longer in power. Is he right?
Well, I think
I know he's nuts, but is he right?
That's a good way to put it. Look, I think the safe thing to say is anybody who thinks they know what the consequence of a kind of sharp political action undertaken on foreign soil will be, you know, should study the history of the Iraq War and what the expectations were before the invasion and what's happened afterwards. I think to expect on foreign soil that if you do A, B will happen, is a leap, not just of judgment, but certainly of great faith that maybe one should think about twice.
All right. Peter Moth, thank you so much for being with us on Morning's Edition this morning.
Thank you.
You take care. Peter Moth, contributing writer for the New York Times. We commend, New York Times Magazine, we commend his article to your attention. It is coming up on 44 minutes past the hour. We're going to take a break. Come back and wrap this thing up. We've got cliff notes. We're going to talk about some other stories that are going on, and we're going to tell you what's happening tomorrow right here on Morning's Edition.
Otasa katata matita. Hear my voice, idolaters, sucklers at the teats of beasts, and every guy named Ron in Hoboken. This is MILF Cardinal Milfington of Rapture Watch. Because I always want to know the latest on what Satan and his toad-licking minions are up to, I listen to the Morning's Edition Monday through Friday, every hubdominal, look it up, from 6 to 9 a.m. here on Air America Radio.
It's 11 minutes before the hour. That's 49 minutes past. This is Morning's Edition. My name is Mark Riley. And, of course, I shouldn't say of course. Those of you who are just waking up, Mark Maron's on vacation. He's probably in the volcano that he was flying over the lip of. Right. Maybe taking a swim in that enchanted pool that he said he and his wife were going to go swimming in. And his stalker, however, is starting to bug me out a little bit. So hopefully he'll be back with, oh, God, he's not even going to be around next week. But neither will I. So maybe he'll stalk you instead, Dan Patrick. Anything's possible.
I guess that's something to look forward to.
There you go. But we got something to look forward to as we wrap and tie this thing. His name is Mr. Kent Jones. Good morning, sir.
Good morning, gentlemen. For those of you who are just tuning in, here are a few highlights of what we talked about on the program. It's time for today's Morning's Edition Clip Notes. President Bush plans to portray the Iraq War in the context of long wars like World War II. Bush originally wanted to compare Iraq to the battle at Mount Doom between the hobbits and the evil orcs until aides were unable to convince him that it really didn't happen.
Ooh.
Ohio Democrats are mulling impeachment of convicted felon Governor Bob Taft. So far, Taft has refused to resign, saying the only way he'll leave office is if someone bribes him. Democrats have nothing to lose, and impeaching Taft would underscore the corruption of the Republicans. So, being Democrats, they'll do nothing.
Ooh.
Impeachment for not reporting gifts is unlikely to be supported by Republicans, who only impeach people for failing to report gifts that are delivered from a kneeling position.
Yahtzee.
Yay.
Connecticut has filed a federal lawsuit over Bush's failed No Child Left Behind law. Experts point out that the Bush administration's commitment to education standards is at odds with their electoral strategy, which relies on the fact that 51% of Americans have to be morons. Today's phrase, just dropping into conversation. Yesterday, Bush spoke in Utah. Today, he's in Idaho. Wake up, sheeple. At this rate, Bush's next stop will be Nuremberg.
Ooh.
Those were today's Morning's Edition Cliff Notes.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kent Jones.
Thank you very much.
Now, you know, I never know when to cut that off. It's very weird. So, you know, we were talking about oil prices, and this is a really tragic story, but I'm wondering now if it's not going to be more and more frequent in the news. A gas station owner was run over and killed the other day when he tried to stop a driver from leaving without paying for $52 worth of gas.
Yeah.
I guess the guy filled his tank. The driver had not been apprehended as of Sunday. Apparently, the gas station owner named Hussein Kadi, owner of Fort Payne, Texaco in Fort Payne, Alabama, grabbed onto the vehicle when the driver started to drive off. He was dragged across a parking lot onto a highway, fell to the pavement, and was run over by the utility vehicle's rear wheel. I don't think $52 is worth my life, I'll be honest with you.
It's true, but
I'd have been out of there before the guy got out of the lot. Just take his license number down, call the cops.
Right.
You know, taking the personal thing. But, you know, this is a tragedy, obviously. And it reminds me of a time I was in Pennsylvania with some friends, and we didn't run over anybody, mind you. But somebody forgot that they were still pumping gas and drove off.
Oh, man.
With the nozzle still in the tank. And gas spread all over the place.
Wait, where were you when this happened?
Riding in the car, saying, "Hey, stop! Please stop!" Yeah, everybody has one of those nightmare gasoline stories, I guess.
I was wondering.
Really? Everyone does?
Sure. Well, not you. You don't use gas.
Do you have one of those stories, Caleb?
I don't have a nightmare gasoline story. I don't know. Do you, Kent?
Absolutely not. Absolutely not.
I think you're flying solo here. Sorry, Riley.
Oh, I'm the only one? No, wait a minute. Here comes B-Mac over here. Brendan McDonald has something.
Yeah, I did it in breach of the company that I was actually working for. It was UPS at the time. And I filled up Big Brown. And,
hello.
Hi.
I drove off without recapping the truck.
Oops.
And the thing with UPS trucks is that you don't have doors on the trucks, so
right.
You have doors, but you drive with them open.
Yeah.
And, all the way down this country road out in Massachusetts, I'm like, man, this whole road smells like this. And then I was able to look out the rearview mirror, and you just see it like, it doesn't kind of stream out, but it looks like a vaporized spray.
Yeah,
being
right.
Like sprayed,
like a jet up in the air.
Yeah, just kind of right out the side of the truck. Which, I mean, the dripping of the gas was one thing. I just was sure I was going to get fired because I left the gas cap back at the gas station.
So
total proof for everyone to know that this big UPS gas nozzle is just sitting in the gas station waiting for somebody to be like, yeah, I think the UPS guy's going to blow up.
Yeah, really. But, you know, one of our callers earlier today said something that I think is kind of profound. One of the first things people do when gas prices get high is they don't fill their tanks anymore. They go,
$5 at a time.
Yeah,
right.
Filler up becomes a thing of the past. It becomes, give me $10, give me $6. $5 will barely get you a gallon and a half
right.
Now.
You know what else is a thing of the past? Remember this? Because I remember when I was a kid, definitely. Let's go for a ride.
Yeah.
Right.
Where are you going? Oh, nowhere. We just want to go for a ride.
Yeah. Well, now it's like take the D train out to Coney Island.
Right. Well, maybe that'll be good. Maybe people will walk more.
Right. Yeah. Now it's like, I'm bleeding. Should I go to the hospital? Yeah, right. I don't know.
Not if you got to call a cab. If you got a car, forget about it. But, I mean, sooner or later. Yeah, right. Sooner or later, something is going to have to give with these gas prices. The U.S. economy cannot take this constant spiral. Now, maybe they'll go down. Maybe Dan Pashman will be proven wrong. And the next thing you know, this time next year, we'll only be paying $1.50. Somehow I'm not sure that's going to work out for us, though.
I'll stake my name on it, Riley. The price of gas is not going back below $2 a gallon ever.
Well, wait a minute. You've been staking your name on the whole idea that Pedro Martinez wasn't going to win, what, 18 games?
15 games.
15 games.
Right now, I'm looking pretty good. You know,
the Mets bullpen is working extra hard to make sure Dan Pashman gets free beer from Kylo.
Well, when I made my prediction back in March, I said there are two things that are going to keep Pedro under 15 wins. His unhealthy shoulder and the Mets bullpen. And so far, I'm still waiting for him to get shelved for a couple of starts when that arm acts up.
Well, no, he's been pitching really well. It's just like, you know, the bullpen the other night couldn't hold the lead. I got an eight-run lead.
They lost an eight-run lead. I can taste those two pitchers of beer. When Pedro had 12 wins 2 months ago, it wasn't looking so good for him. Now he's still stuck on 12. That beer's getting closer.
It was 8-0. They couldn't hold eight runs to the Nationals.
Was that the great Brandon Looper had a hand in that?
Right, Brandon Looper, yeah.
And not for nothing, but they were, like, 2 feet away from losing that game, because that was 2 feet away from being a home run.
Yeah.
Oh, I mean, wow.
Holy cow. How can they blow an 8-run lead against the Expos?
But it's not enough to make you a Yankee fan, though, is it, Chris?
No, are you crazy?
Why did you become a Mets fan, by the way? Just real quickly. We're almost out of time, but I got to know this.
Oh, I was just born a Mets fan.
Born a Mets fan.
You don't become a Mets fan. You were born
DNA.
A Mets fan.
Oh, it's part of the DNA?
Yes, yes.
Brooklyn, Mets. Bronx? No, Yankees.
No, I know a lot of Bronx people that are Met fans.
Really?
It has nothing to do with that.
Those are probably people that hate Steinbrenner.
Well, the truth is the Yankees stink. they're a bunch of greedy Republican bastards.
Oh!
And the Mets represent everything that's good about New York. The Brooklyn Dodgers. The
beer. The fights in the stands.
Look, the Mets.
Pouring beer on top of unsuspecting patrons below you.
No, that's Philadelphia, buddy.
Oh, I'm
wrong
sorry.
City.
No, they boo cancer. Patients in Philly, man.
Yeah.
Philly is a rough town.
They throw batteries at cancer patients.
Listen, we've had a lot of fun. Join us tomorrow. We've got former Labor Secretary Robert Reich joining us, Vanity Fair's Michael Wolff, and the War on Brains. Fellas, it's been great. Have yourselves a great day. This is Air America Radio.
Morning Sedition on Air America Radio.